What you're talking about today and what you'll be talking about tomorrow. This is Straight Talk with Bill McEwen on 1300 KINO.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I just want to remind you that on April 1st, we will be simulcasting here on KINO at the 1300 on your AM dial. But on April 1st, we will also move down to KFRE 940, the old KFRE 940. We will be at 940 on your dial and broadcasting with 50,000 watts of power, so you will be able to get our signal. The Straight Talk Show, the Alan Autry Show, you'll be able to get that from Sacramento to Los Angeles just as clear as a bell. So write down that new position on the dial, 940, where you will hear Straight Talk clear as a bell, and also hear the Alan Autry Show, which runs from 10 a.m. to noon. Again, clear as a bell. And now in the KINO studio with us is attorney David Muggeridge, and he's known for taking very tough cases. He does many murder trials. He's had success at the appellate level, and he also takes some cases that are just pretty darn interesting. And I know you've seen his name in the paper quite a bit, but I thought we would get him in here today to talk about the legal system in general and some of his thoughts on the issues that we face in society today. Welcome to the show, David.
Good afternoon, Bill. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, and I want to just start with this. As I noted before, you are an alumni of San Joaquin College of Law, and this is our round San Joaquin roundtable segment. How is it that you became a lawyer?
Actually, I became a lawyer as a result of an auto accident that my parents had back in 1979, and they were killed by a drunk driver. And I kind of decided at that point that I wasn't happy with the status of the law in terms of the civil liability of the people that provided alcohol. And I thought I should get into the law system myself and check it out and see if I could do something about it. So I went back to law school.
Okay, and you mentioned before the show sometimes because you defend people that are accused of very grisly crimes, sometimes your neighbors look at you kind of askance and question what you're doing. And I thought that listeners would really be surprised when you talk about, one, why you do it, but two, what your politics in general are.
Well, actually, I'm a proud Republican. I've been a Republican since I was first entitled to vote way back when. And I actually kind of feel like I'm a right-wing Reagan Republican doing an ACLU job. But I feel comfortable with that because my basic legal philosophy is everyone is entitled to the best representation that we can give them. And then if after that representation they are still found to be guilty, then let the punishment come. But let's first make sure that everybody gets the best quality representation that we're able to provide in the public sector. And that's one of the things that I think distinguishes American law from the rest of the world.
Okay. Today, though, the system is under tremendous strain. In California, we've seen a move over the last 20 years where people have been very concerned about public safety. They've gone to the ballot box. They have approved initiatives that have changed the law, that have toughened sentencing. We also have laws in California that restrict the amount of freedom a judge has in determining a sentence. In other words, we said, oh, the judges are being way too soft on the people that have been convicted. We need to have these definite lengths, and definitely they've gone to longer incarceration. What are your thoughts on this? Has this been a good thing, or what we're seeing today, are we just cracking under the weight of these long sentences?
Well, to a certain extent, we are finally at that point where we are pushing the limits financially of our ability to do what the people previously have said they want to do. I mean, there's no surprise, even here in Fresno, the Sheriff's Department is under the gun right now. They don't have the money to be able to staff the jails adequately the way that they have to because of a federal law that's out there now, a federal order that's out there. The prisons are not able to be built as fast as we're putting prisoners into them. So I think that we have to stand back, if you will, and kind of ask ourselves the question, how much protection do we want in the United States? And I think that's a serious question. I don't mean that lightly at all. I think when we see new laws that are proposed, whatever they are, we should ask ourselves the question, number one, is this important to me as a citizen in the Valley? Do I really think that this law is necessary? And then number two, if I think that the law is necessary, then how much is it realistically going to cost me? And before we build the prison, before we build the jail, if we're not willing to spend the money that it's going to cost, then we ought to tackle that right up front and not afterwards when we built the jail and let it sit there because we can't staff it adequately.
And I think what we have found, and I know this is my case, I would put that in there. I want maximum protection. I don't know that I can afford to write that check and add to the cost of doing business in California, piling on additional expense anymore. So my thought is, can we be smarter about what we do? In other words, well, let's get to it. The big question is, why does rehabilitation fail so badly in the state of California? Why do we spend $47,000 per prisoner and then have the highest return rate of any prison system in America?
I think that there are a number of reasons that you can look at that explain that answer. There's no one particular segment that I think explains it adequately. Way back when the Founding Fathers framed our Constitution and started the American system of justice and America itself, we believed that when somebody committed a wrong, we would punish them, and at the same time we would try to rehabilitate them if we could, and we would also protect the public. Those are the three stated goals historically for punishment in the United States and incarceration. Somehow we've gotten away from that, and I think what we really need to do is to take the best minds that we have and really come together and ask those same questions. I think it's fair to say, is the prison rehabilitating somebody? And if not, why not? And then I think we should have social scientists, we should have doctors, we should have lawyers, we should have judges. Everybody get together and try to evaluate the problem and try to come out with some solution. Simply, you know, passing a law that says we're going to punish somebody for three strikes, for example. It's a great and it's a well-intended law. But if you ask anybody that's in the prison system now, from the guard standpoint, and a lot of the people that are here locally, we know that we cannot just continue to throw people into the jail or into the prison system and let them sit there and do nothing and then at some point let them out. It doesn't work, and we need to try to do what we can to give them alternatives to sitting in their cell 24 hours a day. Let them learn a trade, something like that. But we've got to do it together as a unit, and we can't just say, well, that's the prison's responsibility, or that's the jail's responsibility, or that's the sheriff, or whatever. I think the community has, as a whole, if they want to have an impact on their own lifestyles, I think the community needs to get active again and to let's hear their voice. I know that there are some not only well-intentioned people out there, but there are some people out there in our own community that are very knowledgeable about this, and I think that we should reach out to them. If I was in a position of some authority, I would want to reach out to them and say, hey, you know, a doctor or Mr. So-and-so, we'd love to have you join a consortium of people that are going to address this problem that we've got and see if we can come up with solutions, because we know that what we're doing now, at least by itself, is not a satisfactory result.
Well, I think the big thing that I see is that you have someone that's convicted of a crime, they're put in a prison system that is so unsafe. If they aren't a gang member before, they have to become a gang member while in prison. And the other thing is they're getting a master's degree in crime while they're in prison instead of being rehabilitated. And so when they come back out, they are a threat to society, more of a threat to society maybe than when they went in. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. In fact, I think a lot of these guys that are going to prison, and I won't just say guys because we do have two of the California facilities for women just north of us here up in Chowchilla. But there's no secret that a great majority of the inmates that are incarcerated for any significant period of time actually come out with a doctorate on criminal law. I mean, they know what is working in the area. They know the police authorities that are out there. And they're being educated in a way that we really would prefer that they not be educated. No question about that.
David, what have you learned from your relationship and the people that you've defended basically about what's the connection there between crime and the way that people are raised? And I don't mean to put it off and say Johnny's a bad guy because his mom and dad were bad, but realistically, what is it that you find?
It has been, in my experience, and I've been doing this now about 28 years, it's been a rare occasion where an individual that's in the criminal system is there and has a great family to back him or her up, where they've had, you know, a traditional type of a lifestyle, you know, two cars, a dog, and mom and dad going to work and, you know, raising a family, maybe going to church together, you know, going to the picnics on 4th of July and that kind of thing. Most of the people that I have seen have come from a very broken up family with little or no positive feedback into you know, the type of a lifestyle that we would prefer that they aim to be involved in. They're raised in a criminal environment, even at home.
Yes, and so what? How do you tackle that? I mean, that's just such a huge thing. We've been trying to tackle that for the last 200 years here in America, and without a lot of success.
And I suspect that long after all of the airwaves have become quiet and there's nobody else out there to produce a program, we'll still be tackling with it. But that doesn't excuse us from the obligation as a society, as a modern society, to try to deal with the problems in such a way that we maximize our dollars that are spent and maximize our efforts, get the right people involved in the right places, and give them an opportunity to affect a change in the system. Unfortunately, what I've seen, and I'm not very political, but I see the results of what happens when I practice law. A lot of very well-intentioned people go out there and they push forward laws, and then we end up with so many people in the system that the jails and the prisons both are forced to give early releases to people. Well, the people that are out there on the street right now, the criminals that are out there running the streets, and the juveniles, they know what's going on, and it's starting to affect them, you know, because they look at it and they say, well, you know, yeah, it's a petty theft. Normally I'd get about 6 months, but I probably won't even do that because I'm the low one on the totem pole here, and they're going to start kicking people out early. I think that's certainly something that we do not want to have that kind of word spread around on the street.
Well, we've been told that inmates at Fresno County Jail can now predict what day that they're going to be out.
And that's sad. You know, when we cannot give the amount of attention to an inmate that we think that they really deserve, and we do it because we have no other choice. I think whatever happens to ultimately the inmates, it should be because we as a city decide this is what we want to have happen. Of course, if we don't have the money to do it, then we've got a real problem. But it's a problem that nevertheless, we can't just sweep under the rug. We've got to deal with it.
Final question for this segment, David, is, and you mentioned three strikes. What are your ideas on possibly changing three strikes so that it is there and people know I commit
right.
a third violent crime, I'm going to prison, I'm going to be there for a long time. So what do we do so it's something of a deterrent, but also something that we can afford and something that offers the hope of rehabilitation?
There are a number of people, not just defense attorneys, there are a number of people that are out there that have looked at three strikes, among other laws, that have said, you know, we could tweak it a little bit that would save us a lot of money and avoid needlessly sending people to the prisons that may not need to go there. For example, I had the sad privilege of having the first three strikes case in Fresno when the law came down, and I represented a young man that was accused of a residential burglary because he went into a attached garage next to somebody's house and stole a weed eater that didn't even work. It was a broken-down old weed eater. Well, that was his third strike. And I remember it was in front of now federal district court judge Lawrence O'Neill, and I attempted to try to convince the court that it should use some discretion and strike one of the prior strikes. And the judge said, well, I don't believe we have any authority to do that yet. And so he didn't want to exercise discretion, and my client got life without possibility of parole for stealing a broken weed eater. Now, I know that people have heard different stories, and that's not necessarily true of all of them. But even if we spend, I mean, just think of it, if we spend all that money to incarcerate somebody for the rest of his natural life because he stole a weed eater, is that smart? I don't think it is. And I think we ought to take a look at that, three strikes in particular, and ask whether or not there's something we can do. For example, why not change it to make sure that the triggering event, the new crime that is committed, is one that is truly worthy of saying, okay, this guy or this gal should go away forever. It's a third strike. You know, maybe it was an assault on somebody, but it was something really significant. The way the law reads now, I think there are cases here and there where people would question the sanity of sending somebody to prison for life for that particular crime.
And to wrap it up, I want to ask you, you know, Superior Court judges, they are appointed by the governor, but then they have to stand for re-election. And I understand why people want judges to be tough on crime, but I would like to see us go back to allowing judges discretion so that they can learn about the individual after a conviction. There can be some thought during the sentencing phase, and the judge's discretion can be put in play. Now, if you have a judge who is going against the grain of the community standard, I mean, we have a chance to remove them from the bench when they stand for re-election. I just would like to see, I mean, a judge is not just somebody off the street. They have experience. They have legal training. Nearly all the time they've shown themselves to be superior in their knowledge of the law and in their work ethic. That's how they become judges. Why not allow them more discretion to determine these sentences?
Well, actually, there still is, if you look at it in one sense, there still is a lot of discretion by the Superior Court judges in California to decide what the penalty is, much more than exists in the federal system, although that's eased up as well in the last couple of years. Right now, the judges have the ability, absent certain commissions of crimes, they still have the ability to impose probation on individuals. I'm not so much concerned about the ability of the judge legally to exercise discretion. I'm more concerned about the effect, realistically, on a judge when he knows that even if he imposes a sentence, the individual will get out earlier than the time that he's imposed because the state of California realistically doesn't have the money to keep them either in the prison or in the jail. And that's got to be extremely frustrating to anybody that's involved in the legal system, from the policeman on the beat to the probation officer, to the district attorney, and to the judge himself or herself. So we need, that's why I say these problems are all interrelated. You can't just say we can fix this one thing without fixing something else. But there is something else in that area that I think that people can do, and it's sometimes overlooked. In fact, probably too many times overlooked. We need to really look when we elect individuals. Now we're talking specifically about judges. When you go to the ballot box, you really need to find out what this judicial candidate is all about. Find out his history. Find out his personality. Find out what he thinks about sentencing schemas. Find out what he thinks about the state of criminal law problems, or in civil arenas, the abuse of the civil system with certain types of personal injury cases. And then after you've done that, go to the ballot box. And, you know, vote in the person that you think best represents the ideals and the social concerns that you've got, because then you've got at least a better chance of going the direction that you want to go, instead of complaining about the judges doing this, but, you know, you didn't bother to go vote yesterday because you were chilling a Budweiser at home on the couch.
Well, and the media has fallen down in that. I mean, it's, the irony is we have more media than ever, but we seem to only focus on a few things. And sadly, I mean, there is not much public examination in these judges' races. And once someone is appointed, they're likely to continue until they decide to retire on their own. We got to take a break right now, David. When we come back, we have some more questions for you. You're listening to Straight Talk on the Big 13 Kino.